I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition.
The Titanic had been missing at the bottom of the ocean for decades until 1985. That's when Robert Ballard located the wreckage about 400 miles off the coast of Newfoundland. Ballard, an oceanographer and Navy officer, developed his own remotely operated underwater vehicle and turned to the Navy to fund his project. After an eight-day search, Ballard became the first person to set eyes on the Titanic. April 14th. 1912 is when it crashed. Another person closely familiar with the Titanic is director James Cameron, along with his Oscar-winning movie, of course. He's actually made 33 dives to the wreckage site itself. James and Robert, thank you both so much for joining us. We understand this is not only a difficult day because for the industry, the exploring industry, but also for both of you personally because you knew some of the explorers on board the submersible. And I know, first off, we're all thinking of their families. Bob, let's start with you. What first crossed your mind when you heard the news today? I understand you both have a deeper understanding of this than most. So what was your first thought today?
Well, when it happened, both Jim and I were at sea on that Sunday, and Jim called me and told me about it, and we both instantly knew that it was gone. Once the data we heard that they were experiencing trouble, they were on their descent, and then when the tracking system went out and everything went out, the only way you could explain it was a catastrophic implosion. And we all have not talked to anybody, because we knew today would be the day when it would be confirmed. Right, Jim?
Yeah, we didn't. I don't think we wanted to come forward. I got, as you did, Bob, approached by many outlets for comment, and it just seemed like speculation, even though we felt we knew what the outcome was going to be, and it was certainly zero surprise to me today. I was even able to visualize the wreck site in my mind over the last few days, and as described, I think it's exactly what we expected. But, you know, I can't imagine what these poor families have been through over the last 4 days, being given false hope here, banging noises, da-da-da, this and that. And, it must have been just, horrible for them. And I feel so bad for them. But I also felt that, as we agreed, Bob, that it would be insensitive to come forward with a dissenting voice to the story that was in motion at the time. I just wish we could have gotten an ROV to the site much, much earlier and gotten eyes on, which took 4 days. This thing just seemed like a prolonged nightmare.
You two
knew exactly where to go. As soon as they arrived, they put their vehicle in and they dove to the spot of the last contact and dropped down, and there was the wreckage.
As I said, you two are so intimately familiar with this site and what it takes to get there. James, I know you were talking today. You were struck by the similarity of what happened with the Titanic disaster to, you know, unfortunately, what has happened here with warnings going out beforehand. Talk to me a little bit about the irony.
Well, it is. Look, people are fascinated by Titanic. They've been fascinated by that story since it sank. And yes, there's the whole, you know, all the millionaires that died and all that sort of thing. But to me, the big irony is that the Titanic sank because of bad seamanship. The captain was warned, and he took a decision to go full speed into a known ice field that he had Marconigram, telegrams in his pocket, warning about the ice ahead. And on a moonless night where they couldn't see anything, they just steamed full speed ahead. And I kind of feel that that's what happened here. I feel that this was such a preventable tragedy. We've never had a tragedy like this in the entire history of deep submergence, deep diving. You have these, highly certified systems like Alvin at Woods Hole, which Bob is very familiar with. Even the Russian submersibles that I dove with, every 5 years they had to be reclassified and recertified, and so on. And you have all these legitimate deep diving operations around the world, and even most of the tourist operations around the world use certification from, let's say, ABS, the American Bureau of Shipping. And this particular outfit didn't do that. I had deep concerns about the technology that they were using, composite fiber wound filament hull, which I don't believe has any place in deep submergence. And I know a thing or two about the engineering that goes into subs. I designed and built my own sub and went, at one point 10 years ago, went three times deeper than Titanic at the Challenger Deep. So, it's all just engineering, and these are understood and known problems. The last thing somebody should be thinking about when they get into a sub to pay to go deep as a tourist or as a, like a lay explorer, they shouldn't have to worry about the sub that they're in. This is just engineering, and it's the 21st century. If you think about when we first started diving deep back in the 60s, the time between then and now is greater than the time between Orville Wright and Wilbur Wright at Kitty Hawk and the flight of the first 747. That's the amount of time that we've had to improve our understanding of materials science and safety protocols and so on. There is no excuse for what happened here, and I find it appalling and tragic.
Just lastly, for both of you, I know you both knew Stockton Rush, the CEO of OceanGate. Bob, you've known him for 30 or so years. So if you both could just talk to me a little bit about who he was, what his dream was, and what needs to happen now that this has happened.
Well, he was a dreamer. I met him. He was very young when I first met him, and he told me about his dream to develop a technology to dive on the Titanic. But that was about it. I wasn't that involved at all. Jim really understands the engineering science on that particular submarine. And like Jim said, every time I dove in, I've dove in 9 different deep submersibles, and I've never worried about the integrity of the hull.
Yeah, you should be worried. If you're going to the Titanic, you should be worried about entanglement or some other problem. You shouldn't be worried about the basic platform that you're diving in. I never knew Stockton well, and I had no association whatsoever with OceanGate, but I was aware of the nature of their design, and I had been very critical of that type of design. There was a prior design that was being built. It was a competing design to ours to get to Challenger Deep back a decade ago, and I was very vocal even to the people involved in that, saying somebody's going to get killed in a wound filament composite hull. It's just a really, really bad idea. And we don't know, we're speculating right now, that was the cause of the implosion. It might have been the dome port, for all we know, which I've also heard was not certified to the depth that it was being dived to. But we don't know right now. But I feel pretty sure that it was that composite hull. But in any case, they never went through any certification process. So that, to me, is misrepresenting themselves to their paying clients. And I guess one of the lessons is caveat emptor. Really look carefully. If you're going to get into a sub, look carefully at the company that designed the sub, look at its certification and all those things. I would also strongly recommend that anybody that's going to take tourists down to a deep site have an ROV on board that can reach the same depth, so that they can assist if there's a problem, especially entanglement, which is really the greater danger for any deep submersible that's operating by itself.
James Cameron, Bob Ballard, thank you both so much. I know this is a difficult day, but you both have insight and have seen things with your own eyes that very few people in this world have. So thank you both for the conversation. And I know also you are both thinking about those who were lost down there and their families, as we all are. Gentlemen, thank you.
Class war, class war, class war. Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother Ramirez Diaz Ocaya. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast, episode The Libertarian Nightmare is producing the exact results it claims to be avoiding. James Cameron recently conducted an interview talking about the submersible, the deep sea submersible, that at this time period, I'm recording this on June 24th, has been discovered exploded, or really imploded, on the seafloor near the Titanic wreck. I come from a culture that honors the dead. I come from a culture that respects the dead, that sees death as partially final, not conclusive. There's two different words there, but partially final, and that to speak ill of the dead is to cast something unsavory unto yourself. For this reason, I am going to hold back on what I really want to say and mention that what James Cameron said in his interview is exactly my point of view. When you have a severe disrespect for the people who came before you, the people who laid the foundation for that which you are now claiming as your birthright, when you have a severe, I'm talking severe, contempt for the decades of work that they had put in, the information, the guidelines that they had constructed due to their decades of work. When you set out immediately to disregard those guidelines, to tear up the, quote, regulatory structures that were put in place through trial and error and research, to make sure those who engage in the activity which you are engaging in not only go through it safely, But at the end, when you arrive home safely, can talk about the joy that it brought to you. When you disregard the guidelines, you are inviting disaster. And I want to speak quickly, ladies and gentlemen, about that term guidelines. I'm not going to use an actual definition here, but I do want to talk about what it means. Because we say it and we don't understand it because it's been completely devoid based on corporate use. Guidelines literally are guiding you along. So there's two things that we have to deal with guidelines. It literally, first and foremost, is guiding you along a line of success. Or several lines of success or development or potential. These are steps and actions and benchmarks that people who had come before you have worked on and worked with through trial and error. They found what worked best, put a pin in it, and said, do this next. And it'll get you to where you want to get to, as long as you're following the other steps. The second way to view guidelines is that it buffers off the zone of danger. It buffers off the zone of danger. It creates a highway. It creates a roadway. It creates what we call a roadmap towards success. And it says you don't want to go beyond this point to the left or to the right because there is danger there. Now, you might have just said, well, politics. It's different conversation. Here I'm talking innovation. Here I'm talking innovation. You don't want to go beyond this point because our research says that this creates death. You don't want to go beyond this point because you'll be in danger of death. Those are guidelines. You ignore them, as the old saying goes, at your own peril. These folks decided to go deep sea submerging. I was going to say diving, but it's not deep sea diving. They decided to go into a deep sea submersible. I forget what the actual name of it is. And the creator of this submersible literally bragged about flaunting all of the, quote, regulations that were impugning his innovation. He bragged about tossing aside the guidelines that had been meticulously developed over the last 70 years as standing in the way of his innovative spirit and his entrepreneurial right. And he said, I can get rid of all this and I'll be able to do what I want to do and everything's going to be fine. There's going to be no consequence for what I'm doing. Negative consequence, that is. And he took people down to their deaths. There is a huge lesson here. When I have talked to people on the streets who have spewed libertarian nonsense that they've picked up from some podcast or some network of podcasts that they're listening to, podcasts that they never question where these people are getting the funding from to live quite lavishly and quite wealthfully, the old English word, wealth, truthfully, they never question who these people are, who they're connected to, what networks do they belong to. They never question any of that. But they spew this stuff like they have been spoon-fed it every day of their lives. The one thing that I ask them that they never have an answer to, because they don't think deeply, and they think for a brief moment that they've been thinking all kinds of deep, till I pose this question to them. What is a regulation? What is a regulation? There's red tape. That ain't a regulation. That's a phrase that is utilized to describe the tape that supposedly is put around these binders that you have to cut through in order to do this, da-da-da-da-da. That's not what a regulation is. What is a regulation? Well, you know, the laws that regulate things. Okay, so you have no clue what a regulation is. Yes. Yes, technically you're right. It regulates things. But regulations are guidelines that are developed typically from trial and error or observation, which creates the environment necessary for not only innovation, but a continuation of the business, the operation that you're trying to perpetuate, while also protecting the people who are involved with the process and people who might be affected from the process taking place but are not directly involved with it. That is a regulation. Whoa. Really? Yeah, that's a regulation. That is what a regulation does. It's a created thing that does this stuff. And it comes from observation. It comes from trial and error. You don't just write a regulation into existence because you just feel like getting up that day and writing a regulation. There's a reason why regulations are so specific. It's because regulations are designed for processes that have already been well thought out, or industries that have already been operating in some capacity for an extended period of time. So you understand what they do well, you understand what they don't do well, you understand their limits, and you understand what they need to be limited in doing and not doing. Because if you don't limit them, they will go and do these things, and it'll have an adverse, a bad, a negatively consequential impact on either people or things, which could be disastrous. Could be disastrous. But because we don't think about regulation, we don't think about what it is, we don't think about why it is, we don't think about the process that goes into building regulation, we just say it's all bad because wealthy people have paid other people to tell you that regulations are bad. Oh. But that is regulation. And this guy ignored regulation. Another way I ask people to think about regulation is this way. When was the last time you thought to yourself, my heart needs to keep beating. My stomach needs to work. My intestines need to work. You don't think about that stuff because there's a part of your brain that actually handles that. It regulates the things that you need in your body to function without you thinking about it. It regulates those things so you don't have to think about it. And you could just go about living. If you didn't have that portion of your brain, that portion of your nervous system, that portion of the organs, if you didn't have a regulatory instrument in there keeping those things going, you'd have to be thinking a million thoughts a day in your conscious mind. Not in your subconscious, but in your conscious mind. Most people don't think about regulations like that, but that's what they do. They keep things going that you don't need to think about, which is part of the task of government. But I digress from that. The reason I started off with the story is because I have mentioned many times about the war on education and how it started in the United States back in the 1970s. Thank you to the Dollop for their great work on the West Virginia textbook wars. But what I haven't done is talked about the fact that libertarians are bringing into existence the world, the exact world that they say they are trying to avoid. A world where the individual becomes subjected to the will of some collective force. Now, a lot of libertarians, especially the ones who do a lot of espousing of this stuff, are very, very wealthy and often have made their money by exploiting significantly labor and not paying labor what labor should be paid for the work that they've done, which I find somewhat hypocritical, because if you believe that a person should have a job and that it is their job to get, it is their task basically, to get as much, to be paid as much, should I say, money as they could for the work that they're doing based on their output, because all libertarians believe that. They may try to dress it up, but they believe it. Then if you are getting your money from a business or an investment, which the workers are having to put out a lot and receive a little, you as a libertarian should be standing up and saying, wait, that's wrong. We should be paying these people what they are actually worth. I'm not saying give them everything that they produce, but we should be capping, you know, 55 to 65% of what they're actually producing and pushing it towards them. You as a libertarian should be taking that stance. But you don't take that stance because you actually don't believe the things that you're talking about. You're just saying those things because, you know, it's profitable. But I digress. The structure which the individual is becoming subjective to is not, quote, big government. It's the same structure that the individual was subjugated to in the late 1800s, the early 1900s. And that was big capital. We really have a terrifying way of remembering stuff. Quick shout out to the podcast No Fair Remembering Stuff from the Professional Left Podcast. No Fair Remembering Stuff from the Professional Left Podcast. No Fair Remembering Stuff from the Professional Left Podcast. It's a great podcast, guys. The only thing that bugs me is it's such a great podcast. I wish it would be, like, every episode would be an hour and a half, but, you know, there are only two people. But we do. We have a terrifying memory in this class. Gore Vidal called us the, I think it was Gore Vidal who called us the United States of Amnesia. And for Freudian slip if there ever was one. For a country who has done what the United States has done, yeah, you might want to have amnesia. But because amnesia is so great here, we really do not know the terrors of or in the past that we have fought through. We don't. Now, black folks, we have ideas. But most white people have no clue of the terrors that was fought through to make possible the life which they're now enjoying. They think they do, and they think most of those things had to do with people overseas or in an earlier time period in American history, people who needed to be conquered. But no, most of what they had to fight through to make their current life possible was produced by the people who were at the helm of this country. So when I talk about big capital, I literally mean big capital. It was so big that the United States government needed a bailout, I think it was 1899, and had to go to, I believe, J.P. Morgan for that. I mean, the United States government was bankrupt and needed money and had to go to J.P. Morgan for it. That would, by the way, prompted a major discussion in the country, which culminated in the first income tax laws. Now, I know most people hear that and they say, oh, income tax laws, it's terrible, it's horrible. It's the first income tax laws wouldn't have affected any of you who are grumbling about it, because it was built on the wealthy. It was built on those who had been promising that if they could do whatever they want to do, made a mention of this before, that they would build a society that everyone could enjoy. Basically, the United States was operating under an oligarchic principle similar to that of the Roman Republic. The wealthy people were expected to not only fleece the public and make a ton of money, but they were also expected to build a commonwealth at the same time. It was similar to medieval England, too, by the way. Well, it didn't happen, and people started getting restless because of it. The reason why radicalism took off so great in the late 1800s to early 1900s, there was a lot of different reasons. I've given a lot of different reasons, and all of them are true. But another reason was because conditions were so horrific. Conditions were so horrific. Hollywood actually does a great job of dressing up what conditions were like in the 1800s and the early 1900s. They do a great job of dressing it up so it doesn't look like it actually was. Conditions were horrific. We look at China today and we hear about some of the horror stories of people jumping from the tops of buildings to commit suicide. That happened all the time in the 1800s in the United States during their Industrial Revolution. We used to hear, we don't hear about it much more, we used to hear about people getting limbs tore off and stuff like that in China and other Asian countries as they were industrializing. And people say, oh, those backward countries. That was the United States in the late 1800s, early 1900s. This is why OSHA and many other things came about, because of the unsafe work conditions. Radicalism was the core central engine, by the way, to all of that progress. Because the radicals were gaining such steam, especially in the urban areas where a lot of people were being hoarded into to work these huge industrial factories, they were gaining such steam that the liberals had to recalibrate. The liberals for a long time had been very much kind of lapdogs to the conservatives. Which is, by the way, that's a history that really Howard Zinn touched on very minutely, is the true radical history in this country. I mean, you could write a multiple volume book on the true radical history of the United States, and it would be all interesting, because most of what you think of as radical isn't that outside the norm, actually. It really isn't. But I won't get into that. Radicalism caused the liberals to readjust themselves because the people, the average ordinary person, saw the liberal as just empty. They didn't have anything to really offer. More, the radicals were talking about using federal power to regulate and control, in many instances, industry. Now, why did that appeal to people? Why did that appeal to people? That appealed to people because there was no structure that had proven strong enough to rein in corporate power, to rein in big capital. And since there was no structure that had proven itself capable of doing that, the only thing that was left was state power. Now again, I've mentioned this in previous episodes, folks who had come to the United States of America from overseas, they had a memory of old history. They had a memory of old orders and or social orders and old social orders and how those old social orders were utilized to keep criminal and authoritative tendencies in check. They had memories of that. And so when they came to the United States with those memories in hand, they looked around and said, oh, well, those old orders would work really, really well here to kind of curtail this insanity. And they started working from those memorized blueprints to create new institutions here, predominantly the labor unions. There was also labor fraternities, which we don't really have anymore. There was also labor temples. Those were actually something different than the fraternities and the unions. And then you had the labor orders. The last three mostly having gone by the wayside. They've mostly disappeared by now. And that was nothing compared to, you know, the attempts to build journeymen and apprentice systems here that mirrored those from Europe. All of these things appealed to people who had been completely disempowered by corporations and by the urban industrial landscape. This changed the political dynamics of the period. Liberals begin to see that there was a more, and I don't even know if they would have been called liberals at the time. They might have been called moderates or something to that effect, centrist or something. But they started to see that there was a more institutionally involved way to see government. The shadow, and let me add this quickly, because this is I think very important to this story. You have to understand the shadow of radicalism, the true shadow of radicalism, touches history at every turn in the United States. And not only does it touch history at every turn, it has a drastic impact that has rarely been well documented. Rarely has it been well documented. It's kind of what I'm learning about black history right now and how intermingled black history is with making America what America is and what America shall probably never be. Whole. Radicalism at key moments in the historical evolution of the United States has played a role in setting the course of where America's going to go. Now, that course could be positive or it could be negative. It depends on where the reactionaries are. but they're always there to set the course. And that must be remembered. So the liberals started seeing, that government could be more involved. And to undercut a lot of the radicals, and let me be very clear also, there is a lot of radicals in government at this time period. When we talk about progressive Republicans and progressive Democrats, we are talking about people who are one step removed from being radicals. This is very different than a lot of the progressives today. You also had radical Republicans and radical Democrats, and the radical Democrats typically were not good, but the radical Republicans typically were decent. And because of this, they were able, because of their presence, should I say, they were able to push liberals and form this coalition of, okay, we can get things done that changes the position of government from being a lapdog for big capital and big business and monopolies to being the overseer of big capital and big business. And we can use them to either control industry, which is what a lot of socialists wanted, or we can use government, federal government power particularly, to regulate big business so it cannot crush the individual, it cannot crush their communities, it cannot crush regions, it cannot control monopolistic power. And they begin to work towards that. And as they begin to work towards that, there was a backlash, as there always is. Now, there is an interesting history which I heard about years ago. And that history dealt with whether or not Wall Street had its hands in the revolution, the communist revolution in Russia. I do not 100% believe that Wall Street had anything to do with it. Or, no, let me rephrase that. That Wall Street was behind the revolution. But it is not impossible for me to believe, considering what the United States was known for doing at the time, that they may have had a hand in trying to orchestrate it to move one way or another. To varying degrees of success. But I bring that up. Because this backlash, which was very minute and very small in the beginning, really came into existence in the 50s and 60s, and the 40s, to be honest. Okay, in the 30s. They literally tried to orchestrate a fascist coup in the 30s. I have to remember that. I always have to remember that. So, okay, in the 30s. It took a couple of years for them to get together their weaponry to go to war with what they saw as an encroachment on the rights of big business, of the oligarchs, to rule over the United States. The United States, by the way, and I think this is interesting, a interesting concept that somebody needs to do some work on. I discovered a new word looking through my dictionary a few months ago called polygarch, where you have multiple points of power, of controlling power in a specific country. The Roman Republic, the Roman Empire, when they had, I think they had three or four different emperors, they were a polygarch. The United States, I believe, fits the definition of a polygarch. You have the federal government who orchestrates power, but you also have the oligarchic structure, which is reminiscent of Rome. Now, I just wanted to throw that in there because it's something that's been kind of in the back of my mind. Now let's connect this to libertarians and what they say they actually want to create. The books, Copeland, Dark Alliance, The Republican Noise Machine, and there's one more that I'm absolutely kicking myself because I'm not remembering it, and I should remember it, but I'm not. Yeah, I'm not. They track brilliantly the strands of oligarchic tendency towards recapturing territory which they have lost. And they do it without recognizing that that's what they're describing. But yet that's what they're describing. The pushback against the New Deal was a desire to recapture markets which these business people, again, operating off of principles that were operating in the Roman Republic, that they were trying to recapture markets which these people saw as rightfully theirs. To do this, they started developing language, messages, concepts, which they could then feed to the public. And it took them a while to figure out how to do it. You know, they tried newspapers, but their newspapers sold well, but they didn't sell as well as some of the other sensationalist stuff and some of the other radical stuff. Then they did radio. Radio, they had a lot of success with, which opened up the door to, okay, well, if we could do radio, if we can do radio, then we should look for mediums that enable us to get right into the home to talk to these people. TV came next. And then the internet. People do not realize conservatives were very early on, and so weren't libertarians. Because I'm realizing now that a lot of the early conservatives that I heard about on the internet were actually libertarians. They were early on creating websites on the internet so people could have access to it. Not only were they early on the internet, but they made sure people knew where to find their stuff so that they could then talk about it in their circles. I remember the first time I heard Matt Drudge's name. I was listening to a radio station out of Rochester, New York, a pop radio station, the morning show. I was listening to them before I went to school. If I'm not mistaken, it was 1995. It might have been 96, but it wasn't later than that. And the host, Scott Spisano, very Italian guy, still on the air today, not on the same channel, was talking about something he had read in the Drudge Report. And I was like, who is Drudge? Almost 30 years ago, Matt Drudge was working, was doing its thing. Of course, I should say, if memory serves me correctly, because it may not be serving me correctly. Maybe I'm confusing, 1995 or 96 with 2004 and 2003 or something like that. But I believe it was back in the 90s, if memory serves me correctly. Now, with the utilization of these mediums, libertarians have dispatched language that convinces without presenting evidence, that convinces without presenting evidence, that convinces without presenting evidence. They have not only dispatched language that convinces without presenting evidence, but they have also dispatched and distributed language that creates a formulation of the world which explains the past to the present and instructs for the future. Yet, at the same time, that language deceives. Now, obviously, you're like, well, yeah, if they're presenting stuff without and convincing people without actually offering evidence, of course it's going to deceive. But it actually deceives in a much, much more scandalous way than that. It deceives because it purports to want to create freedom by cutting all of the lines and tethers that have been instructed and created and formed through trial and error via historical memory. Nope, wrong words. Via historical record. Not memory, but record. Via historical record, it wants to cut all of that and promises that the resulting freedom will be significantly better than the freedom that was created via that historical record. Here's the only problem with that. They know it's a lie. You know how I know they know it's a lie? Because there's places in the world that do not have those tethers, but yet operate a capitalist system like the one they want operating here. And the result is not good. I'll give you a great example of this. There was a case brought before United States court, which most of you probably heard of a couple of years ago, where an indigenous group wanted to sue a corporation over dumping toxic oil waste, might have been an oil spill actually, in a pristine area of forest. And I've seen the videos, I've seen the pictures of what, it is terrible thinking about that stuff, what it actually did. I mean, it is just disgusting. It really is. And what the result of them dumping that stuff there has done to the people locally, what it has done to the vegetation locally. One of the things that sticks out to me is they pulled up what looked to be these luscious green plants, and the roots and the mud was caked in oil. Well, because the state that was done in, the country that was done in, has no real power over those corporations, the corporation was able to bribe whoever they needed to bribe to keep any cleanup minimal, meaning none, and to keep their liability very, very minimal, meaning none. And in the United States, it was, I don't know if it was dismissed or what, but one of the responses to cases brought in the United States against corporations who do things in other countries is the corporation will be like, yep, okay, you know, enforce it. Whatever your decision is, if it's against us, enforce it. Now, if it's against them, hey, we'll make sure it's enforced. This is the type of world that they want to create. This is the type of world that they want to create. And yet, they are convincing everybody else that that's not the world, that it's going to be something greater. Now, I started off talking about education. I started talking about education, and I want to get back to that briefly. It's funny, recently I was on a podcast, one of my local podcasts, they asked me to call in to talk about Juneteenth, and I said, let me say something briefly, and the host, you know, friend of mine, he jokingly said, you don't say anything briefly. I'm like, yeah, you're right. You're right. You know, it's kind of like a Baptist preacher in that way. But I promise this will be brief, to the extent that I can make it. When you go after education, as libertarians and corporatists, oligarchs, and all the like have been doing for the last 50 years, I cannot stress this enough. This has been going on for 50 years, y'all. 50 years. When you go after education, in a world that is rapidly changing, you defund education, because that's what they've been doing. Republicans, conservatives, libertarians, oligarchs, corporatists, all of them have been working to defund various things that have a huge impact on our society, and yet we don't talk about the negativities of them defunding stuff. But when black folks say defund the police, which really means, you know, take the excessive amount of money that policing gets rather than, you know, other social programs and put it into those communal programs, you know, now we can have a deep discussion about why black people hate America. Anyway, returning, when you do that when you go after education, you defund education, you deprive it of the necessary resources that it needs. In a world that is rapidly evolving, I cannot state that enough. I watched a lecture from the mid-1980s where a black professor of anthropology and something else was discussing, not anthropology, he was discussing the abysmal state of education and what he saw coming down the line, and the guy was near on point with what he was talking about, and if I could remember his name right now, I would tell you who he was, but my mind is blank. I ain't watched it since like 2015. Anyway, when you do that, when you go after education like that in a rapidly evolving, changing, shifting world, what you are essentially doing, especially when it's prolonged, I mean, if it's for a couple of years, okay, but when it's prolonged, when it literally is 50 years worth of this attack, worth of these experiments which failed horribly, all of this stuff, what you are essentially doing is you are methodologically, systematically taking the competitive edge of your population away. I'm talking about from a global perspective. You are stopping your population from being able to compete with people whose government are pumping in a lot more resources to their educational systems. Not only are you stopping them from being able to compete, you are hindering your actual entrepreneurship. Why? Because so first and foremost, let me get this out the way. One of the greatest things that education can offer people is up-to-date lessons. Lessons that are reflective on what has been taught in the past, what has been learned in the past, and what has been gathered in the past. You can present that information to a new generation. That new generation can then take all that information and create from that information. That's one of the brilliant things about reading books, mostly from the late 1800s and the early 1900s, is people were well aware of what was happening in the present and what had happened in the immediate and extended past. And they often wrote that way. I'm not saying everybody, but a lot of folks wrote that way. Today, it's different. We're very much disconnected from even our immediate history. This impacts entrepreneurship because when you have a collective education or an education that is collected from a historical record, there's that phrase again, especially one that starts in the immediate present and moves through the immediate future and then continues on backwards. What you hand to the person is a record, a log of what has come before them, what has been learned, what has been cautioned against, what has been limited off, what has been suggested as courses of action, strategies of actions, and where they actually are placed in that history. Now, that is formulated differently depending on the subjects that you're dealing with. That's formulated differently depending on the subjects which you're dealing with. However, when you're talking about something such as submersibles that are going deep into the ocean, it'll tell you, you don't want to ignore the stuff that people before you have written and told you to do and not to do, because death will come, or the possibility of death will increase so substantially that it could end badly quicker rather than slower. Now, away from the submersible, how you like the callback, this also tells you politically what has worked in the past. It also tells you this economically, what has worked in the past, what hasn't, what has been learned, what has been limited off, what has been guarded against, and where you should stay to remain safely within the bounds of all of that. Where the guardrails are and why they are there. What happens when you go beyond the guardrails? What happens when you penetrate the outermost of the guardrails? All of that is collective record keeping, and it is passed on through education. When you attack that, when you strip that away, well, you can't really be mad at a generation or generations that are disunited from what has been created in the past. And not only disunited from what has been created in the past, but they're disunited from themselves. They don't see themselves as part of anything bigger. Now, I give credit to this current generation. I'm still looking at, okay, what is the metaphysical reason behind the clumping together of this generation? Is it just simply because they see the disaster waiting in the next 30 years and they're like, yeah, we ain't going to do this individually. We have to do this as a group. But still, there's limitations in just doing it as a group. You need institutions that go from the ground level all the way up to the macro. But that's neither here nor there. Libertarians are creating a nightmare. And yet they're selling it as creating freedom. And they are literally structuring. They are literally structuring institutions that are forming a new Dark Ages in America and probably beyond. Because it's not going to be limited to just one place. You can see it already with how the culture is being spread out throughout the world. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, I'm your brother, Vladimir Diesel Gaia. You can always reach out to me. Radio, the number 4, ALL.net. Radio, the number 4, ALL.net. Speaking of questions, comments, concerns, I need to answer a question sent by Steve S., if memory serves me correctly. Steve S. He asked, I think it's a he, why do I use the song by Jackson Browne at the end of each episode? He had never heard of it prior to listening to the podcast. It's funny, so let me toss this out because it is really kind of funny. So when I first started the podcast, I didn't have introduction music. I didn't have outro music. Nothing. It just started and ended. I first discovered Jackson Browne and this song particularly back in, like, I think it was 2007. Maybe 2008. And no, I apologize. It was 2009. I was watching a, I think it was Bill Moyers video from the 80s. And he actually, it was called Constitution in Crisis, something like that. And I can't remember exactly what it was about now. It was about some scandal in the Reagan administration. Oh, I think it was about the October surprise. No, it was about Iran-Contra. Sorry, it was about Iran-Contra. And if I remember correctly, he played this song in that video. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, let me find this. So I typed in the lyrics, boom, it came up. It became part of my immediate rotation of songs. There's actually a couple of songs that I really dig from Jackson Browne. This is a good CD, by the way. If you get this CD, Lives in the Balance, it's a really good CD. It's a really, really good CD. Or an album back in them days. Anyway. So when I was doing the creation of the introduction for Class War Battlefield podcast, which took me a while to actually come up with, I think I worked on it for about 6-7 months. About that. I was about to say a year, but I don't think it was that long. And I, once when I finished it, and I was finishing up my first episode, I was like, I need a song for the end of the podcast, because I just can't end it. And I had a couple of songs in mind. And as so happens many times in life, mistakenly, I went to hit another song for, I was putting together a playlist while I was re-listening to one of my old episodes, and I clicked by accident Lives in the Balance. And the show was coming to an end, and Lives in the Balance started playing, and I was like, oh. So I stopped it really quickly, stopped doing the playlist, and backed up a little bit, played it, and then hit Lives in the Balance. I'm like, yo, this is my outro. This is my outro. And boom, it became my outro ever since. And then I was looking at the connection between starting with Marvin Gaye and then ending with Lives in a Balance. And if you think about the themes of both songs, I'm a deep spiritual guy. You guys know this. I've said it before. But if you, I don't believe that the ancestors, I don't believe that God works by accident. I believe it's all in coordination. And if you think about the themes of both of those songs, man, they fit together like a glove, man, like a glove in hand. It's great, especially the beginning of Lives in a Balance. I mean, it just, I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. And you can, I mean, it's a brilliant song, a brilliant song. Jackson Browne is a treasure to this country, and he does not get, especially in recent years, the man doesn't get credit for what kind of a great artist, real artist, with real present day clairvoice talent. Nicole Sandler, I think, was talking about on her show some, maybe a year ago, about how well he still sounds. How well he still sounds. And this is important because a lot of these people who are singing today, when they're his age, their voice ain't going to be there because they don't take care of it like you're supposed to. But I'm done with the question. Thanks for sending it in. Again, question, comments, concerns, radio, the number 4ALL.net, radio, the number 4ALL.net. I'm your brother, Varmira D. Sogaya. If you want to support the work that I'm doing, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast. PayPal it, Cash App it. You should be seeing on my cover art now, there should be a Cash App, what are they called, barcode. So you can just zoom with your phone, send me some money, $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you could do. Help me keep this thing running strong. I have some ideas, but I'm going to need time to do them. And, yeah, I'm going to be busy for the next couple of years. I'm your brother, Brian Meredith. Big up to Dr. Oba Deshaka, Black Power Media, Professional Left Podcast, Best of the Left Podcast. All of everybody who I normally give a shout out to. Much love to all y'all. See y'all in the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or